This is the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast brought to you by Art Wiederman, CPA with Ide Bailey. Whether it's taxes and investing or planning wisely, Art is the expert to make your dental practice profitable. At Ide Bailey, what inspires you inspires us. We provide a suite of accounting and advisory services dedicated to the total care of your practice. Visit our website to access our tools and resources tailored for dentists, idebailey.com/dentist. That's idebailey.com/dentist. This podcast is distributed with the understanding that Art Wiederman, CPA, and Ide Bailey, LLP are not rendering legal, accounting, or other professional advice. Listeners should consult with their business advisors before acting on any of the information or opinions shared. If you have questions and or feedback, make sure to email Art over at awiederman@idebailey.com. That's A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N at E-I-D-E-B-A-I-L-L-Y.com. You can also give Art a call at 657-279-3243. Without further delay, here's your host, Dental CPA Art Wiederman.
And hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast with Art Wiederman, CPA. I am your host, Art Wiederman, and I am happy to be with you today. And my topic today is very, very interesting for people that want to grow their empires. I'm getting more and more calls, folks, from people who are saying to me, oh, I'm going to open multiple practices and my friends have done it and I want to have two or three or five. And then I want to sell to a DSO or to private equity. And I'm getting a lot of that. And that seems to be happening. There are a lot of emerging DSOs, hundreds of them from what I know. And my guest today, Perrin Desportes, whose company is the Next Level Executive, is the perfect person for me to talk about this subject with you, because I've been looking for someone who helps to scale as a coach someone from one practice to two to three to five. And folks, I can tell you, I have a lot of clients who have two practices, and you can handle that on your own, probably. But once you get to three, four, five, seven, 10, now you're starting to talk about IT and HR and having a CFO or a fractional CFO, and it gets very complicated. And we have a lot of folks who have tried to do it, and they get frustrated, and it becomes a 24/7 job. So Perrin is going to talk to us today about what you should be doing if you want to scale to more than one location. And I've talked to Perrin before, and he is an incredible resource for this subject. So we'll get to him in a moment. We are recording right now, the beginning of February. It is tax season. You know, it's like Bugs Bunny used to say, rabbit season, duck season, tax season, right? Well, it's tax season. And I always know it's tax season because that's when all the commercials for Tax Act and TurboTax come out on TV. They were on yesterday was the Super Bowl. And if you're a Philadelphia Eagles fan, you're very happy. If you're a Kansas City Chiefs fan, not so much. But I know it's tax season. So if you are not getting the level of service from your CPA and they are not a dental specific CPA, we've got you covered at Ide Bailey. We work with close to 1,000 practices and dentists together across the Western United States. Please call me at 657-279-3243 or email me at awiederman, W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N, at idebailey, idebailey.com. A couple of things I want to mention. I've talked about this on the last couple podcasts, as we have had this these horrible wildfires in the beginning of January here in Southern California. The city of Pacific Palisades has pretty much been wiped off the map. And the city of Altadena in the San Gabriel Valley is not far behind. And I have been working closely with the California Dental Association, the West Los Angeles Dental Society, and the San Gabriel Valley Dental Society. If you are so inclined to help the dentists, we have, from what I gather, 20 or more dentists that have been compromised, either having lost a house or a practice or both in these areas. And I suspect it's a lot more than that. I have to check up on the numbers. I would ask that you go onto the website of the California Dental Association Foundation, CDA Foundation, and there is an icon for wildlife relief. We at Bailey have donated to this, as have my wife, Lynn, and I, because I strongly believe in the dental profession, and it has been very kind to me in 40 years. So if you can, go to the CDA Foundation's website, and if you, again, feel so inclined, donate to their fund, and they're going to use the money to help the dentists in the recovery. I also want you to put April 23rd on your calendar. We are now rolling out the first of our four Business of Dentistry webinar series, and I am so excited about this. We have in one of the hours, might be one of the most prominent dentists in the world, Dr. Sherilyn Sheets, is going to do a course that will qualify for a unit of CE for you. It is going to have to do with cracks and teeth. And Dr. Sheets, I've known Sherilyn for 40 years, and she is, to use the word incredible is an understatement. You'll get a lot of great education from her. And we are also going to have Ben Tuinay. One of the topics I want to cover in this Business of Dentistry webinar series is going to be how to change your relationship with insurance, how to deal with insurance companies, get better reimbursements. And Ben, there is no better expert in this in the country than Ben Tuinay. I've known him for many years. So if you want to sign up, please send me an email at awiederman, W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N, at idbailey.com. And we will send you the sign-up sheet to click on the icon and sign up for the webinar. It is free and is being sponsored by the Orange County Harbor and San Gabriel Valley Dental Societies.
Be sure to check out our new Ied Bailey podcast, Ebb and Flow, a business podcast providing inspired insight on issues and trends the middle market faces. Hear unique business stories, get answers to frequently asked and unasked questions, and understand business topics that matter to you. Available now on your favorite podcast platform.
All right. With that, I'm going to get to my good friend, Perrin Desportes. Perrin, again, has his company, which is called the Next Level Executive. And I've had conversations with Perrin about what he does, and it is very impressive. And if you are thinking about being a multiple practice owner, maybe you are one already. Maybe you own one or two or three locations, and maybe you have partners. That's what we're going to talk about today. So, Perrin, welcome to the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast.
One artist to another art. It's good to be on with you. I've been looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for having me with you today.
Oh, no, we'll have some fun. Now, I understand, Perrin, that you have some expertise in a prior life. You were actually a performance driving instructor. So if I had a brain fart and decided I wanted to drive a high-end Maserati 150 miles an hour, you were my guy, right? Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, when we're single, we do a lot of crazy things in life, and I have a passion for sports cars, and used to own an older 911, a Porsche, and a couple of buddies said, hey, if you really like to drive that thing, why don't you come with us and take it to the racetrack one weekend? I thought, well, okay, there are a lot worse things to do with it, I guess. So bought a helmet, took it to the racetrack. An instructor hopped in the car with me, threw no controls on the car whatsoever, but gave me guidance on how to navigate the car around a racetrack and progressively get a little bit better each time. And it was a hobby that I did for about 10 years and was an instructor for three or four different car clubs, Porsche being one of them. And it was a lot of fun. I used to tell people that everybody's got to do something to get away from stresses of life. Some people play golf, some people play guitar or paint or, you know, ride bikes or whatever else. I used to put on a fire retardant suit, a Hans device, and a helmet, hop in a car, and go fast around a racetrack. So it was a lot of fun.
That reduced your stress level, you're telling me, right?
I would say that in that environment, you are not thinking about anything in life other than what is in front That's of true. You or around you. So it is a cerebral pursuit more than people can gather. Yeah.
Well, I've been told by my family, friends, and everybody I've driven with that I drive like not a grandfather, but a great-grandfather. So I don't know how well I would do. And I've only driven a stick shift once. And I can't remember my single days because May 11th will be my 40th wedding anniversary. So wow. We'll see what happens. And I'd like to stay alive till May 11th. So probably won't be joining you with that. All right. Hey, listen, tell us about your professional journey.
Yeah. So, I'll try to be brief because my family owned a dental distribution company of all things, a business that was started in 1899 in Charleston, South Carolina, called Thompson Dental Company. Much like Patterson or Shine, it was a family-held business, debt serviced, and we sold capital equipment, technology, consumables, just like Patterson and Shine did. I was fourth generation in that business. My father was president and CEO when I came into the business in 1995, and my grandfather was chairman of the board. I worked for the company for 7 years. I'm, I guess, a little bit biased, but I think it was a pretty well-run organization, was growing right nicely. And we made the decision to sell the business to Patterson in April of 2002, not really for financial reasons or operational reasons. The company was growing profitably every year and was on the run rate to about $100 million in revenue that year, had about 14 different sales offices in the Southeast. But the reason we decided to sell the business was due to poor equity transition planning from my grandfather to my father and my father's two sisters, neither of whom worked in the business, nor did their husbands, nor did any of their kids. So in a relatively illiquid business, when two-thirds of the ownership doesn't work in the business and only wants to get their money out, that creates some leadership challenges. And so we can get into the merits of equity and ownership at a point when we start talking about associates, but yeah. I got to see a little bit of that near and dear. I was fortunate to be able to stay on with Patterson for 15 years, and I ran three different businesses for them, from Richmond, Virginia to New York, New Jersey to Charlotte. And I always wish I could have worked with my father a little bit longer, I'll tell you that I learned things about corporate America and enterprise businesses that I probably never would have learned had I not had that opportunity. And they really gave me a lot of responsibility at an early stage. I ran the Richmond operation at the age of 31, and I had P&L responsibility, and I didn't know what that meant at the time, Art. And if I did, I might not have taken the job. So it was a good career. My branches won a handful of awards. I acquitted myself fairly well as a young executive there. Left Patterson in January of 2017 to launch a startup venture with a couple of partners that became what's known as Tusk Partners. And then my partner, DeWalker Sinha, and I left that business to launch Polaris Healthcare Partners in March of 2021. And I just finished my transition out of Polaris at the end of 2024 to launch the Next Level Executive, which is a solo venture that builds upon all of my experience in corporate America, being an entrepreneur, and consulting with a lot of group practice owners to hopefully, bring some value and guidance to people who might want to do the same.
Well, we're going to let you share all of that knowledge that you say that you have, which I believe that you do. Let's start with the conversation, Perrin. So one of my listeners, or many of my listeners all over the country, are sitting here and saying, yeah, I really want to scale. I have one practice. I've done it really well. I'm making a decent income, but I think I can do better. I want to have an empire. I want to do this. I want to do that. Let's talk about the mindset of the entrepreneur, okay? And there are some people who should do this and who should not. Who's the right dentist that should own multiple practices, and who shouldn't?
I might take those in reverse order, if you don't mind. Let's talk about who shouldn't, because I've seen a lot of people with really successful core practices almost sink the boat by going down a road that they arguably shouldn't have. So let's talk real quick about successful dentists or even healthcare service business owners. And dentistry, when you reach a level of success clinically, financially, and operationally, you get you run the risk of having Groundhog Day, where every day looks like yesterday and tomorrow's going to look a lot like today, right? And, you know, usually that's from a standpoint of there's minimal chaos in the business. There's probably minimal staff turnover. You've got great relationships with patients. Your case acceptance is, for all intents and purposes, 100%. You're making good money and you have a nice lifestyle for you and your family. And you get bored. And Art, you and I both know that bored people make bad business decisions. And the reason for that is they delude themselves into thinking that it's easy because they've reached a level of success in their business that they have ultimate control over because they operate within those four walls. And they start to make short-term decisions with longer-term consequences. And that manifests itself when they decide that because they're bored, they need a new challenge. And what would be a better new challenge than just going off personally guaranteeing a bunch of new debt and buying another practice? A practice that may not look, feel, function, or operate anywhere close to the practice that they have currently. And now they're indirectly working for the bank because it probably doesn't generate the free cash flow necessary otherwise. So if you're mid-career and you have a successful practice, however you define successful, and you're contemplating adding an additional location, there are a lot of things you need to think through before you do so. And there's a lot of preparation you need to take before you decide to pull the trigger. I would also tell you that every bit as much as people who are bored making bad decisions, people who try to keep up with the Joneses make equally bad decisions. And just because you've got a buddy from dental school who frankly wasn't that bright, and he or she has built a 10-location group that they just said that they sold to somebody for a gaudy sum of money, you shouldn't conclude that it's easy. And because that bozo did it, you should do it too. That's an equally bad decision.
And especially for people in mid-career, and I'm going to call mid-career, I don't know, 35 to 50. And at that point, I mean, when I was in that stage, I mean, I had two boys. I was going to, you know, water polo practice, baseball practice, track and field, wrestling, all this stuff, Boy Scouts, and just trying to raise your family. And when you start, Perrin, and you're running, and now you've got two or three locations, you've got millions of dollars of debt, or maybe you have investors, I don't know, and you've got 20 or 30 employees, it never ends, right? So talk about the why. Why does somebody want to do this?
Yeah, and let's go back to a phrase you started the question with that I think is really a prudent place to start, and that's mid-career. So we think about somebody at mid-career creating a great level of success for themselves, but the other side of that coin is they've got half a career yet to go. They probably can't retire outright, and they probably also have a lifestyle that's calibrated to the level of income they derive from their practice.
Yes, absolutely. You know,
and I hate to say they're treating their practice like an ATM, but that's kind of the case, right? So who should contemplate adding additional locations, and why should they do that, and what can they do to prepare for it? So I would tell you that if you're you know, five-ish years before retirement, it's not worth the headache, it's not worth the hassle, it's not worth the stress of the personal guarantee to do it. You need to keep the boat, you know, glued together and land the plane, so to speak, to draw upon different analogies. But, you know, it's probably not worth the risk is my point. If you are a mid-career, I think you got to think about a few things and see it eyes wide open here. And that is the following, that running a healthcare services practice, especially where you are the largest clinical producer, the chief economic engine of the business, if you intend to do that for another 10 to 20 years, we gotta be mindful of the fact that dentistry is very physically demanding. And you and I probably know a lot of clinicians who have had debilitating physical or emotional conditions that render their ability to practice diminished at best, or you know, no longer existent at worst. I also think that running a small business of any sort is really challenging in today's economic environment. High wages, increased cost of goods and services, the commoditization of the profession, which we can talk about down the road, all of that places a lot of pressures on the owner himself or herself to be a Swiss Army knife and to be excellent at all of it. And that's just really challenging to do. Adding an additional location, or maybe two, or possibly three, over a longer period of time, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years or more, can be a prudent defensive strategy. Defensive in several ways. One, creating some degree of economies of scale for negotiating power. You mentioned insurance reimbursement and Ben 2A earlier, and that would be, you know, a little bit of size and might makes right with that. Purchasing power to your Shine, Benco, Darby, Patterson, whoever is your supply company certainly would be an opportunity. The ability to maybe better capitalize on your headcount and your wages would certainly be one. But the last thing I'll say is, in a business such as dentistry, a clinical profession such as dentistry, it's really prudent to build a business that's not dependent upon your clinical skill set for its existence alone. And being able to have a multi-provider type of a business where you can derive some degree of passive income if something were to go wrong is a prudent defensive strategy for you and your family. So that I would say that if you're mid-career and you're trying to de-risk the business in a way, not to go off and buy a bunch of locations, you know, helter-skelter, but to do it methodically and predictably and build from strength as prudent. We can talk about some of the mistakes people make if you'd like as well.
Well, we're going to get into this now. I'm going to put my CPA hat on. So
yeah.
We tell doctors that a good profit percentage of your collectible production is somewhere between 33 and 38%. I think you would probably, I would hope you would agree with that. That's the numbers I've been using for a long, long time.
Yeah.
We see doctors that are lower than that. And then we get into, well, gee, if you're running the kitchen sink through your practice, then you got to take that out and all that stuff. But when you are doctors, when you buy a practice, and Perrin, when a doctor buys number two, number three, and that's what we're going to get into next, when they buy the next practice, you know, they're not going to do the work. They're going to hire an associate dentist who, number one, is not invested the way you are as an owner, unless you make them an owner. We talk about that too. So you've got, you know, you're paying someone 25 to 30% of their production, and you have to service debt. Now, it depends on whether you get the money from investors or you get the money from banks, and we'll chat on that. So let's talk about, so the bottom line is I'm looking at, if I do it right, netting after my loan payment, what, 10, 15%? I don't know. If you're lucky.
Yeah. That's generous, Art. Yeah.
That's generous. All right. So they're going to lose money on every additional practice they should buy. So they should buy a whole bunch of them. Maybe they get a discount. I don't know. But I mean, the numbers have to work. And then, so let's start about talking about, with that in mind, acquiring practices number two, three, four, and five. So number one, you get somebody comes to you and says, hey, I got a really good practice. I got a vision. This is what I want to do. Cover number one, how many per year? Because I've had doctors who have literally bought 10 practices in a year. And I go, you're insane. Yeah. You know, you just need to, you need somebody to help you in the head because it doesn't make any sense. So how many per year? How close should they be? Same type of practice? Get into that a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So let me even take one step back before we pull the trigger on that.
This is your platform. Please tell me what you want to talk about.
So when somebody comes to me and says they want to acquire their first practice, the first question I ask them is, how much cash on balance sheet do you have right now? Now, remember, I just said that, you know, none of us do what we do for free. If we run successful practices, we're probably pulling out most of the income, most of the distributable income, and funding a lifestyle. What I want to find out is, what type of margin for error do you have at home? And what I mean by that is if your lifestyle, if you've got a couple of houses with mortgages and some new cars and kids in private school and a country club membership and all this other kind of stuff, that's fine. But if your lifestyle is dependent upon 100% of the income coming out of your core practice, you have no margin for error. And that is a bad position to be in, because the dirty little secret is that everybody who starts to acquire additional practices takes an income hit to do it. The question is, how long is that income hit going to last? So if you take an income hit, meaning it doesn't generate free cash flow after debt service, after you acquire this next additional practice, are you going to be in conflict with your family? And if the answer to that is yes, that's a really bad business to be running, because you literally have no home to go home to. So let's talk about how much cash reserve you have, because as you start the process, you're probably working 4 days a week clinically right now. As you start to acquire this practice, maybe some additional ones, maybe you're going to have to split time between the two or keep the thing glued together. You've got to pay an associate to do the work that you're no longer doing in your core practice. And that doesn't come for free. Nope. So if you don't have cash built up to weather that dip in personal income, you're going to be in a world of hurt right away. The next thing is, when we do start looking for practices, just because you're a general dentist and it's a general dentistry practice does not mean that you should buy it. One of the core lessons you can learn effectively from enterprise-level DSOs and the men and women who work in the business development offices of them is that they don't swing at every pitch that comes across their plate. They are very disciplined and they are looking for a reason to say no. So, for example, if yours, Art, is a high-end fee-for-service practice that hums like a top, and you're looking at making your first acquisition and it has 30% Medicaid concentration, I would tell you that those two businesses are staffed differently. The clientele, the patients are different. The way you operate them is different. The marginal profitability is different. The compliance is different, being a Medicaid-driven practice. It's probably not in your strike zone to pull the trigger and acquire that, because the integration of it's going to be a problem. So we want to figure out what we're looking for from a minimum criteria. Is it Medicaid? Is it number of operatories? Do you want the seller to stay on indefinitely, or do you want them out the door on day one? So create your minimum criteria and don't swing at pitches that are outside of your strike zone. And then the last thing I would say, and this gets back to your, you know, acquiring too many practices and negative free cash flows and things like that. The last thing I would tell you is that when we look at a practice to acquire, when I'm working with somebody, I ask them, what are the top two or three things you feel that you can do to minimize or cut some of the expense structure in the business? Is it cost of lab and supplies? Is it headcount? Is it professional services? What is it? Like, where do you think you're gonna be able to take some of the cost out of the expense structure? And what are two or three things you're gonna do to grow revenue? If the seller was referring out all of the implants and you have the ability to do guided implant surgery or clear aligners or advanced endodontics or something along those lines, all on X treatment, great. How much of that did the seller refer out, and how much do you think you can keep? Because now we're talking about revenue generation, we're talking about expense containment, we're talking about increasing marginal profitability that gives us greater confidence on being able to satisfy the debt service and be free cash flow positive.
Let me ask you a question about PPO reimbursements, insurance companies. At what point, Perrin, does someone have some leverage with these insurance companies? Obviously, if you own two locations, I'm guessing you don't have a lot of leverage. But I talked to one of my doctors who actually sold to a large DSO. I won't mention any names, and they have hundreds of practices. And what he told me is that the reimbursements that he got once he sold, because he kept a partnership interest in it, were actually significantly higher than what he was getting. And he was actually making more money working for the, you know, in the partnership than he was making on his own. So where is the point where someone is, well, if I own two practices, I can go to the insurance companies and I can make a killing here. What's that point?
It's a difficult question to answer. I'm not going to try to dodge it, but what I will tell you is the blanket statement, insurance negotiation is a cornerstone of every enterprise level group's ability to create value beyond what the seller was able to do. So they, depending on their size and volume, that is one card they play off the top of the deck. And what you just, the story you just told is commonplace. It is 100% applicable. If yours is a practice or a small emerging group in an area where it's one particular insurance plan or company that's not represented in other practices around, or maybe they're not any other practices, then maybe you have more negotiating power than you give yourself credit for because nobody else is subscribing to that plan. So it can be a lack of options from the insurance company that create upside for yourself. One to two locations is going to be difficult to create a whole lot of leverage. You know, you get into four to five and they'll start to pay a little bit of attention to you. But it is still something that you should make an effort at every year because they're not going to come to you with preferential reimbursement rates if you don't ask for it. And I think this is one where we know that due to the ADA studies that they've done for a while, that insurance reimbursement rates for traditional solo practices are stagnant at best, declining at worst.
Right. So let's talk about like location. In other words, and again, getting into the reason why. I mean, people are going to own multiple practices to either, as you said earlier, generate passive income and just grow their empire, and maybe they're making an extra $300,000-$500,000 a year. I don't know. Or they're going to build their empire to ultimately sell it and get that 4,000 times EBITDA return that everybody's getting, right? That was sarcasm, of course. And so, you know, talk about that. Talk about the growing. Where should these practices? I mean, I know of DSOs that have practices all over a 10-state region. Does that make sense?
No.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that's why that's the answer I wanted to hear.
Yeah. So I think there are people who are simply trying to acquire a lot of dots on a map, create operational and financial challenges for themselves that are almost insurmountable. You want to have some degree of geographic density. And I even tell people that if you've got if your core practice is no longer accepting new patients, you have totally maxed out your capacity in terms of days and hours and provider productivity, then possibly acquiring a second practice that is within a geographically concentric circle of your core business could alleviate some of the capacity constraints in your core business. So in a roundabout kind of a way, cannibalization can work to your advantage in this situation. And we see that occasionally. But I think the key for all of us when we're starting out this journey is that you have got to be able to integrate the acquisition successfully, and you've got to be able to operate it indefinitely. And that means that if you have a regional operations manager or VP of ops that has to split time between your locations, we would like for the drive time to be at least be reasonable to allow that person to spend different amounts of time. Or if you happen to lose a provider in that practice, and you yourself have to moonlight for a little while in location number two until you can get it backfilled, that it's not 100 miles away.
Makes sense. You had mentioned an operations director. Let's talk about, and then I want you to talk a little bit about what you do and your work. Let's talk about, as we grow this empire, I had mentioned earlier, we're going to need at some point, we're going to need some help with HR. We're going to need some help with IT. We're going to need some help with accounting. And by the way, doctors, If you have multiple locations, we at Ide Bailey have a fractional CFO service that's second to none, and we can help you, and we do help doctors with that. So you've got accounting, you've got IT, you've got HR, you've got all kinds of things. So when do we need to add, because these are layers of overhead that are going to cut into your profits when you own this. So how many practices do we need to own before we need to start adding some of this administrative director of operations? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I think this is it's a really good question that people tend to dive into head first, and it creates some financial challenges for themselves. You can overhire and overtitle someone very, very quickly that's not necessary to operate the business. If you are going to have a fully functioning C-suite, a true like VP, director, VP, or C-suite, you're going to invest a lot of money in administrative overhead. You're probably going to start to do that between 5 and 10 locations. You're going to form a true management company or DSO to centralize a lot of these back-end services. And if you decide to do that, you owe it to yourself to probably build what would amount to around a 20-location group to get it to be a positive ROI financially and for the hassle you're going to undertake to do it. And for those who are committed to the journey, that's quite all right. But for those of us who are looking at, you know, building a 4 or 5 location group over the next 10 to 20 years, you want to make sure that it's operationally sound. So a somebody with operational experience and leadership experience that can keep the operations of the business glued together while you as the founder are probably going to be the visionary. And I would say, Art, the other role that is neglected or people are unaware of the impact of it is a chief clinical officer role. And that is really, really critical in the emerging stages of a group practice. And we can dive into that too.
Sure. Take a second, Perrin. I mean, you're obviously very knowledgeable about how to help doctors scale. That's what you do. Talk about your company. Your company is called the Next Level Executive. Where are you based out of?
I didn't ask Charlotte, you. Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah. I just flew there last week to do some charity work, and we helped on. By the way, if anybody needs drywall pulled down, I was doing that in a house for 2 days in Asheville. Helene was Helene was absolutely incredible and devastating. And so if anybody needs drywall taken down or molding taken down, I'm your guy now. I've got now new skills. I learned how to use an oscillating saw and all that stuff. But anyway, Charlotte's a beautiful city, by the way. So talk about what you do and how people can get a hold of you.
Yeah, so I kind of rolled through it pretty quickly, but the prior two ventures, startup ventures, Tusk and Polaris, were consulting and M&A transactional companies that focused exclusively with group dental practices. And, you know, I found that doing a lot of consulting work, the target client was probably about, I don't know, 5 to 10 locations to be able to afford the service, to be able to apply the service and need it. But, you know, beyond the level of a traditional dental practice management consultant that might work at an operational level with somebody in their first practice and south of a true consultant that would provide strategic consulting resources, there's this segment of emerging groups in the middle where people start to really make a lot of mistakes for themselves that are totally avoidable. It happens between about 1 in 5 locations. That's just a rough number, not hard and fast. But when I started looking at the space more, I really felt like these were a lot of men and women who had successful practices. They were successful, clinically speaking. They had advanced clinical skill sets. They'd work with a dental practice management consultant. They had a solid operation, and they were wondering what's next. And if I go back to my years at Patterson and running different businesses as a young leader there, I could always look up the food chain in the organization and I could say, oh, if I want to take the next step as a leader, that's how you do it at an enterprise level, or that's how you do it in a major market, or that's how you do it to run a publicly traded company. And I got to be mentored by a lot of very successful business people who'd been with the company for a while. If you're a successful dentist, you reach the top of your food chain really, really quickly. And yep. There's nothing to model your behavior by. When I say behavior, I mean your professional development here. You know, what makes the difference in success and failure in a 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 location group is not your clinical skill set. It's your ability to lead it, to make interconnected decisions, to talk about partnerships with associates, to look at buy versus build, to be able to read the tea leaves of the industry and to make decisions and understand that the decision you make today isn't going to box you into a corner down the road. And I just identified that segment of the space to say, look, there's really nowhere for these people to go for professional development, to become a more effective executive, to be a better entrepreneur for the business they're trying to build. And that is my entire career and my skill set, from being a consultant, from being an entrepreneur myself, and from working in a corporate America environment. So Next Level Executive is the company that I started. I'm a company of one. I'm an army of one and an HR department of none. How about that? So
you're smart.
Well, honestly, I want to keep it that way because it's a business that's it's a coaching business for people who want to become a more effective executive. I work with entrepreneurial dentists who are on their growth journey from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 locations that want to be more confident in the decisions that they make. There's a core curriculum that I teach over about a 12-month period. It plays off of 4 major themes, which are leadership, execution, structural alignment, and business development and growth. And between those 4 themes, all the sessions that I teach, and it's about 1 a week, play off of those themes, a different theme every quarter. So we have about an hour video that I share with them. I teach a PowerPoint about a particular subject. And then we get together on Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock Eastern for about 90 minutes and go through an open Q&A of what people are challenged by with the subject matter, what they're challenged by maybe that's not in the subject matter, that's just other problems they're having, and how they can feel more confident in terms of owning and leading the businesses that they've taken the risk to buy and operate. So it's a dynamic group that has heavy application, but I think it's solidly oriented at the stage of growth of many of these emerging groups.
So doctors, if you're looking at taking this journey, Perrin is a wonderful resource. And that's the beauty of what I've done for 40 years is I don't know everything. My clients think sometimes that, you know, Art, you should know this. I go, no. I mean, do you, Dr. General Dennis, do you know how to do all on fours? Well, maybe you don't. Maybe you do, but you probably don't. So, we have people that specialize in this. So, Perrin, if someone wants to talk to you, maybe they're thinking about starting the journey, they own a successful practice, and as you say, maybe they're bored, or they've maybe started the journey, but they're having a little bit of like, oh my goodness, what have I got myself into? Well, give out your contact information, please.
Sure. The website, which is the easiest place to start, is thenextlevelexecutive.com. Thenextlevelexecutive.com. You can find out a lot about me. You can find links to my podcast, a blog that I write. You can find more details about the program and an opportunity to enroll for the coming quarter if you'd like. There's a lot of information there. You can also book a call with me directly off of that website, thenextlevelexecutive.com. And I take calls from people almost on a daily basis about, hey, can I run something by you? Or this is where I am. What do you think? You know, I do those exploratory calls all the time. So wealth of information there. And if you want to email me directly, it's my first name, Perrin, Perrin, at thenextlevelexecutive.com.
Okay, thank you for that. You had mentioned leadership, and I know that's a big thing that you talk about. What is leadership in your mind, and what do you need to be a good leader if you're running an organization that's got 5 or 10 or 20 locations and potentially 100, 200 employees, and what talk about leadership and what you teach your clients.
Yeah. So this, we could do a podcast series on this one, Art.
Sure,
so
I'm going to
try. Yeah. I'm going to try to spare you and your audience and be brief on this. So leadership comes down to a couple of things in my estimation. Foremost, it is creating greater results through other people than what you could create on your own. Okay.
So I like
whether
that.
Yeah, whether it's a healthcare services business or a sales company or whatever else it is, but if you can create greater results through the people who roll up to you, report to you, or on your team than what you could do on your own, then you are leading through others. And it's critically important, especially in a healthcare services environment, to embrace that, to understand it, and learn how to do it better. One of the central hallmarks of a great leader is his or her ability to communicate at a multitude of levels. And let me be clear on that. When I say communicate and at a multitude of levels, it could be one-on-one. It could be in a text message or a written note card standpoint. It could be in a small group environment. It could be over a webinar or a podcast like what we're talking about. It could be from a stage in front of 100 people in a company address. And the magnitude of what you create differs at different levels, and it also differs at the given different point of time of the evolution of the business. So I've been through a number of times of trial in my career where we were challenged by adverse scenarios in the marketplace or layoffs or something like that. And I had to communicate messages that weren't real fun. That's where you figure out how much your team trusts you, whether they're going to believe what you're telling them and they're going to follow you even when they don't understand it. And our ability to communicate clearly to people is of paramount importance if we're going to build a growing organization and if we're going to do it with people who support us without having to look over our shoulders.
I mean, I have one of my dear, dear friends in the world is Dr. Phil Potter. He's my partner in my transition business, and he taught me a very, very simple term that I live my life by, which is the truth will set you free. You know, and if you are truthful, I was a leader of my organization for 33 years. I had a CPA firm with 10 employees, a couple hundred, 200-300 clients. And I was always honest with everybody. I always said, you know what, guys, we're doing great. Or, you know, in 2008, it was the only year that I didn't give raises to my employees. And I said, guys, you know, we're down 15%. This economy is kicking our butts, but we're still standing, and that's the way it is. So being right, you got to be honest with people.
Yeah, I agree. Even when you're telling them something that they don't want to hear, and I think that's where it's a referendum on the level of trust that you have built up previous to that incident or that situation, and you know how much credibility amongst your team you have at that point. It's a challenging thing for all of us to go through, for sure.
As with all these podcasts, I need at least 5 hours with you, and I don't have that. So I want to cover a couple more topics.
Yeah.
Metrics. You know, we're growing this empire. I'm assuming that you use some of these metrics programs that are out there, Dentametrics, Dental Intel, something like that. What metrics, when you're doing your coaching, do you get into that? What are you looking at? What do you tell the doctors to be looking at?
Yeah, so I'm going to go, instead of getting in the weeds, I'm going to go higher level for you here.
Okay.
And let's break down a couple of them. Depending on what sources you're looking at, many forecast the industry, the dental industry, business of dentistry, to grow at 3-4% on a compounded annual growth rate over the next 3 years. So 3-4% in the aggregated market. If you're building a group practice, you need to be growing at least 5% faster than the market. So we're looking at high single digits to low double digits in terms of revenue here is what I'm talking about. I would also tell you that if you are acquiring other practices, magically, your top line revenue is going to look really, really great when you add additional locations. So we look at same store sales to make sure that each of the individual locations are growing 5% faster than market, not just the business and an aggregated format. The next thing is, as you well know, the hallmark of any efficient business is what we call operating leverage, and it's simply growing profit faster than sales. So if you and I are growing our revenue at 5% faster than the market, say 10% revenue growth, but our profitability is stagnating, not growing at the margin level, then why are we doing it? And we're not gaining any leverage out of our operations. You should be growing your profit faster than sales. The next number I would look to is something that we call utilization rate. Utilization rate is measured on a revenue dollar per chair per hour, annualized, obviously. And the reason that this is important is because it is foolish, in my opinion, to go out and personally guarantee bank loans to buy additional locations when you have untapped potential in your current locations. So when we look at the fixed capacity of each individual location for a general dentistry practice, you want to be somewhere between $125 and $175 per chair per hour. On an annualized basis, that's usually a barometer of a pretty well-run practice from a revenue generation standpoint. And from an EBITDA margin standpoint, 18 to 25%, high teens to mid-20s at the margin level would be a hallmark of an efficient and well-run operation.
One of the owners of one of the biggest DSOs said, we're shooting for 20-22%. So yeah, you're right in the ballpark. And you have to look at numbers. You have to be a business person. Let's loop in the CPA. So the CPA, do you like someone who understands dentistry? What is the CPA's role in helping that entrepreneur grow their empire?
So I talk with the people in our program a lot about something I call a personal board of advisors. You and I both know that most enterprise businesses have a board of directors. But, you know, for a personal board of advisors, who are the people in your inner circle, be they paid or unpaid, that are giving you guidance for your business and personal growth and development? And if your accountant does a lot of hair salons and a few pizza parlors and a lot of other stuff, and they file your taxes on time and they just make sure the IRS doesn't come knocking, you are not getting out of an accounting relationship what you should. They should be on your personal board of advisors, and it takes accounting into more of the financial reporting aspect than simply the tax compliance aspect. And this is critically important because I think that there are too many accountants that aren't specialized in terms of healthcare services or dentistry that can't provide any comparative metrics from a benchmarking standpoint, first and foremost. Is your expense structure compared to general dentistry practices of your like size and shape, are you where you should be? Or is there potentially greater efficiencies to be gained that you're not realizing yet? If your accountant doesn't have the ability to compare and contrast, then I'm not really sure what type of business guidance they're giving you. When you start getting into more locations, obviously financial reporting from a management cost center standpoint becomes much more important as well.
Yeah, and a lot of it too is doctors. If you're looking at buying multiple locations, we've done probably close to 1,000 accountant due diligence examinations. I mean, you know, one of the things we look at when you're buying a location is, does that seller have a second location 3 miles away? I mean, if you're buying a $1 million practice from somebody who's got a location 3 miles away, don't you think that some of those patients might go to his other location and that's going to affect the price? And all? And I know you've worked with Scott Haberman in our Fort Collins office. That's worked out pretty well for you from what I gather.
I was going to say, you guys at iBailey have been tremendous from a fractional CFO standpoint, Scott Thorne and some of those guys. And
oh, yeah.
Scott Aberman and I have just, we've been friends for a long time, and he's been a great resource. I refer y'all a tremendous number of clients at every opportunity that I can, because I know the guidance that you and your team are going to give, and I know that it's going to be a point. You have the ability to draw references from other like clients that you work with, and you can bring experiential wisdom to the table to somebody who's just enlisting your services that arguably other firms are not able to do. And to me, that at the end of the day, that saves time. It accelerates a client's learning curve quickly. And y'all do a really, really good job of educating them exactly what they're looking at.
So do I need to send you $5 or $10 for that commercial announcement about iBailey? No, we're very proud of the work that we do at our CPA firm. I want to cover a couple more things, and then we got to call it a day.
Yeah.
Let's talk about like structural alignment. I mean, do you like, I mean, if we get into 5 to 10 practices, we know we're going to have 5 to 10 to 15 associate dentists. Who do we give equity to? Do we just keep them all as employees? What do you like to talk about in that realm?
Yeah, there's an entire quarter in the program around this for good reason.
You got a couple of minutes, so yeah. narrow it down a little bit.
So it's an interconnected, you're talking legal structure, you're talking financial reporting structure, you're talking equity and ownership practice versus management company, and then what I call governance. As the founding member or our founding dentist in the group, how do I lead and govern this from a voting standpoint? What do I have the ability to do or not ability to do? There's a lot to it. I believe in the merits of equity. I mean, I kind of prefaced that in my background when we opened up the episode. And I believe that people who are owners in businesses are more committed. They show up early, they stay later, and they stay longer. They also tend to take better care of patients and staff. So I believe that equity is a point of stability and a motivator for the right candidate. That being said, before we go off and do anything, we want to make sure that our vision and what we want to do with the business is aligned with what their expectations are. And specifically, we want to know that if we allow somebody to buy in or earn in equity into the business, be it from a profits interest unit or a restricted stock unit type of a scenario, we want to make sure that their commitment to the business is what ours is. We don't want something called a non-operating partner. Hey, Art, I like being an owner. I'm just not going to be a clinician anymore. You know, I'll just cash the checks when you distribute it to me. Have fun running the thing, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, what happens if I want to build a business? I want to take on a lot of debt. I want to buy 10 locations in 1 year and I want to sell the thing in 36 months. Well, that might be different if your risk tolerance is maybe buying or building one every couple of years and building a cash flow business for the long haul. You know, there's a lot of differences in the way we think about business, what we want out of the business. And if our visions don't align with our partners, it will create a mess that is problematic and costly to unwind.
Well, you're very clear, and I agree with you 150%. Last thing let's talk about. Okay, so now we got our leadership going. We got our metrics going. We got practices that are netting, you know, 18 to 25%. We're growing. Same store revenues are growing. Our profits growing faster than our revenues. Everything is looking really good. We got the infrastructure in place. Now, let's talk about if the exit strategy, and I'd be curious as to what percentage of people you think are looking to exit, what percentage just want to keep it as a passive income. But for those that want to exit, okay, what do we need to do? We need like, my understanding is that the DSOs like centralized, everything is the same in all the locations, and we're using the management program. If we get down to places where we're dealing with call centers and we're integrating a big, that's easy. So what are the things that the DSOs are looking for that they're going to give us that higher multiple of EBITDA?
Yeah. So I would tell you, going back prior to COVID, everybody was building a business to sell a business. There were a lot of people that did coming out of COVID. And there are a lot of people who are building businesses now that are looking at their contemporaries, seeing that the recaps didn't quite materialize to the degree that they were forecasted. And maybe they want to hold the business for longer. So most of the people now are building businesses for cash flow purposes and aren't necessarily in a hurry to sell it. Right. That being said, it's important to understand the business that you built, how big it is from an EBITDA volume, and if it already has the management company, C-suite characteristics, centralized services, everything I talked about before. If that's the case, if it has all that professional leadership and back-end infrastructure, you might be a target for what we call a financial buyer, a private equity group that is looking to enter the space of dentistry, and they're looking for a cornerstone acquisition. They're going to build a business around that and leverage the infrastructure for greater growth. Now, that type of an investor, a private equity group looking to make an entrant into the space, could be willing to pay a turn or two more in terms of EBITDA multiple valuation than what a strategic would be. A strategic is, like you mentioned before, a Heartland Dental, a Pacific Dental, an established enterprise group, usually private equity backed, that's already in the space. If you're, you know, 1 to 5 locations, 5 to 10 locations without centralized administrative infrastructure, the logical suitor for your business is going to be an enterprise level DSO that's already in the market space that already has that professional management built into it. They're not looking for yours. They already have their own. But they'd be willing to pay a multiple of EBITDA, which is far in excess of what a bank-funded group of associates would be able to qualify for.
And there are DSO. And one more thing. I know that you came from the M&A side.
Yeah.
I am adamant, and we're doing this seminar by the time this podcast will have been aired, we will have already done it, talking to sellers about, you know, what does it look like selling to a DSO? And it's really, really tough. They are looking, you know, they're looking for cash flow. Private equity is looking, you know, if they're going to be involved with a DSO that's backing you, they're looking to flip it in 3 to 5 years. I mean, that's why they buy it. Their investors are high net worth individuals and family offices that have millions, sometimes billions of dollars, and they are looking at high risk, high return investments. And private equity and they love dentistry because dentistry generates cash flow. So I think it goes back to kind of put a bow on this podcast, Perrin, is the why. You know, why are you doing this? Are you looking at, you know, it's going to complicate your life. You're not going to work 40 hours a week. That's over. It's a full-time, 7-day-a-week job, and the aggravation never ends, and you've got to be able to build the infrastructure to do this. So any final comments, and I want you to then give out your contact information one more time.
Yeah, look, I'm incredibly bullish about the next decade ahead of us. I know everybody's talking about consolidation in private equity-backed groups and 80% consolidated. I don't believe any of that.
No, there's no way that's happening in dentistry.
No, I don't believe it either. And I also think that, especially with the cost of debt funds still at this point, I think this is a wonderful point in time that if you are mid-career and you're methodical about adding additional locations, slowly building from a point of strength. I think there are a lot of young associates that don't want to work for a DSO and don't have the risk tolerance to do it on their own. And they're looking for a doctor-led group that makes decisions from a patient standpoint and is good for the providers. And this is the perfect point in time to build a simple, small group through control and statement of purpose, why we're doing what we're doing, and really build it for the long haul. I think it's a wonderful time to be a dentist.
And I'm going to make one comment, and then we'll close this out. And again, I want you to give out your contact information, and please stay with me as I take the podcast out, Perrin. So we've been talking this whole podcast, folks, about how do you build the empire? I want to talk to the doctors on this call here, on this podcast, who have a practice. You're doing a million, million and a half, 2 million a year. You love what you do. You love your team like family. And guess what? You get to leave at 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon to go coach your kids' baseball. I mean, that was the thing about me as a CPA. During tax season, I didn't care. What I knew I had to get the returns done. But every time there was a baseball game for my youngest son, Forrest, or every time there was a wrestling match or a track meet for my oldest son, Nathan, my secretary, Debbie, it's on the couch, says, Art, you got to leave, got to go. And guess what? I'd come back and work at 9 o'clock at night and get the tax returns done. So doctors, if you are thinking about that, you want quality of life, you want to get up and leave at 3 o'clock to go to your kid's baseball practice, you know, you might seriously want to think about, do you want to go down this road? Maybe making $400,000 or $500,000 a year is going to allow you to fund your kids' college education. It's going to allow you to fund a retirement. It's going to allow you to live a nice life. Yeah, I mean, do you go to Italy on a private jet every 2 weeks? Yeah, maybe not, but it's going to allow you to do this. And I want you to think about, yeah, your buddy, you know, who you went to dental school with, you're just like, well, wait a minute. He just sold a 10 location practice to XYZ DSO for $40 zillion. And I didn't. And I'm a terrible person and I'm a failure. No, you're not. So I want you to think about that, doctors, is if this journey is right for you, Perrin's a great guy. And I'm going to, again, let's give out contact. But doctors, if that's just, you know, you don't want to complicate your life, and it will complicate your life, don't do it. Does that make sense, Perrin?
It makes 100% sense, Art. I'm 54 years old. The reason that I exited Polaris last year is because I have an 11-year-old daughter, my wife and I do, and I want to spend time with her the way you did with your kids. And I know that building a growing business has demands, especially when there's a lot of business development and travel and client work and everything involved with it. And I didn't want to miss those weekends. So let's make sure that if we're building a group or whatever we're doing, that it's that our business is congruent with the lifestyle we want to lead, and we don't build a prison for ourselves.
Absolutely. You are a prince, my friend. That was a great call. I love doing calls like this. Again, my three happy places, and my listeners for 6 years have known this, is on a golf course, on a fly fishing stream, or in front of a microphone. So this is great. One more time, how do we get a hold of you?
Yeah, thank you for that. Website is thenextlevelexecutive.com, thenextlevelexecutive.com. I've got a podcast called The Next Level Executive. You can find it on the website or on Apple, Spotify, or any of those outlets. If you want to book a call with me, you can do that off the website. You can see all the other information about me and blogs and everything. If you want to email me directly, it's my first name, Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N, at thenextlevelexecutive.com. Social media handles, links, and all that are on the website as well. I'm, for as weird a name as Perrin Desports is, I'm pretty easily found. There's only really one of me out there.
Well, you know what? I don't talk about people's names because Arthur Wiederman isn't the most common name either. So there you go. Perrin, thank you so much again. Hang with me as I take the podcast out. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to again thank you all for the honor and privilege of allowing me to come into your homes, your phone, your computer, however you listen to this podcast. We got thousands of listeners all over the country. I get emails. I see them at the dental convention. By the way, if you are coming to the dental convention in May, I didn't mention this, May 15th through the 17th, I will be speaking with my good friends at Bank of America on Friday. I believe it's 11 to 1:30. Please be sure to send me an email at awiederman, A-W-I-E-D-E-R-M-A-N, at eidbailey, eidebailly.com. If you would like to attend our first Business of Dentistry webinar, which is going to be with the amazing Dr. Sherilyn Sheets and the equally amazing Ben Tuone, talking about crack detection in teeth. On the clinical side, one, you'll get some CE credit for that, as well as how to deal with these insurance companies. That is April 23rd from 6 till 8 p.m. California time. If you email me or call me, 657-279-3243, we'll make sure we get you the information. If you are so inclined to make a donation to help the doctors who were devastated in Pacific Palisades and Altadena from the California wildfires, I would go on to the CDA Foundation's website, and they have a link to make a donation for wildfire relief. And if you are looking for a dental CPA, we got you covered at Ide Bailey. Please give me a call, 657-279-3243, or aweederman@idebailey.com. And with that, thank you again for listening. And that will be it for this edition of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast with Art Weederman, CPA. Thank you for listening. Please tell your friends about the podcast, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. The Art of Dental Finance and Management podcast is produced by Ide Bailey in partnership with Art Weederman, CPA, Decisions in Dentistry Magazine, and the Academy of Dental CPAs. For audience questions and feedback, email Art Weederman, aweederman@idebailey.com. That's aweederman at eidebailly.com. Or you may call Art at 657-279-3243.